Do you need some more members for a posse?
I'll be part of your posse.
Okay, Gretchen, are we ready?
Well, the problem is the phone line, but we can start.
Yeah, well, what we can start with is introductions.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to welcome everyone here. This is your headquarters, our regional headquarters, of course, for DC Water and Sewer Authority, DC Water. And this is a LEED Platinum Plus building that we're very proud of. And for some of you, this is your first time here. The building is special in that it's, I think it's the first building in North America, in the U.S., to use Canadian technology of heating the building off the sewer pipes. And it's that's why you'll see windows and stuff around some of the mechanical works. And then also, there's a lot of technology in these windows. And the as you can imagine, the reason we have the green windows here is because of the southern exposure. The other windows have automatic blinds that adjust with light. And that brings a lot of the cost of the operations of the building down. Additionally, the building is built right on top of sewage pumping station. So that's why, one reason why it's wrapped kind of in an odd way when you have the one walk in, is that there's operations that it's wrapped around. And so, of course, DC Water owns the land, and it's a it was a very smart investment, and it will ultimately save the tax the ratepayers quite a bit of funds. But very proud to welcome everyone here. I wear a lot of hats. Apparently, DC is still not big enough to where we have to do a number of jobs at once. And so I'm the chair of DC Water as well. And just welcome. And then I will let, I know we've got a couple other members of the DC Water Board here, and Steve and Adam. And let's go around the room and introduce ourselves. We'll start with my friend Adam Ortiz.
Hi, good morning, Anthony Williams, Bishop of Columbia. Adam Ortiz, Montgomery County Department of Environmental Protection. Good morning.
And I'm Hal Siegel. I represent Washington Gas, and my colleague Steve Jowitz is joining us.
Yeah, Michael Stevens with the Capitol Riverfront Bid. Welcome to our neighborhood. We're glad you're having the meeting here. Beautiful building.
Stephanie Paul Williams with the Maryland Department of the Environment.
Jerry Molino with Prince George County Department of the Environment.
Steve Joe Farmer, Governor County Department of Environmental Protection.
James O'Day with WSSC.
Eric Verhoff with the Hunting Industry Council for Mecca.
Ryan Hamilton with the U.S. Department of the Interior.
Bill Matuszewski, you know this BMAT, and this says I am representing the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay.
Trey Sherrod, Anacostia Riverkeeper, and DC Vice Chair for the Anacostia Watershed Community Advisor.
Red Bull, Clean Water Action.
Jim Foster, Anacostia Watershed Society.
Walter Smith, DC Appleseed.
Fred Pinkney, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Simeon Hahn, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration.
Maureen Holman, DC Water.
Hi, good morning. Steve Bieber, Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments.
Are we ready yet to invite those on the phone to introduce themselves?
We are still working on that. There's a new conference post.
We're still working on that. There's a new conference line number being sent out.
Okay. So so that everybody knows that this is the... this is a blended group. It's the mayor's leadership council for the Anacostia River. And the members have been duly appointed, approved, and sworn in. And then we also have invited members to join us from our consultative working group, which includes the potential responsible parties. That consultative working group has met a couple of times, and it made a lot of sense to bring both groups together. And so that is who we have here. But because, just so you know, because we're also sitting as a body of DC government, that we're subject to all open meeting laws. And so this is being recorded. And that's, you know, this is, and so well, our minutes or notes or whatever we take from this, it's all part of open government.
and the laws of the government. So with that, most of you have an agenda. Most of you have the agenda in front of us. I know that this is the last scheduled meeting, but I think we may think that we want to schedule another one in a fairly short period of time. That what we made a commitment to you is that we sent out the draft feasibility study. We asked for comments back. We cataloged the comments on the matrix to see what are the ones that have the most common themes of not one position or another, but things that people wanted to talk about. And so that was the last meeting, and now we're going to this meeting. We're continuing along that, and that's the commitment we made to you in this process. Now, I believe at least one other party to this, and I don't know if it's just Pepco, but maybe Pepco and Washington Gas, has asked for additional topics to be discussed. And so what I'd like to do is get through what we've agreed on and work through the things that you've already been prepared to talk about today. And then look at, if we don't have enough time today, then we look at adding another meeting to be sure that Pepco can bring their issues to this body for discussion as we still drive towards a record of decision. And with that, as opening statements, with your permission, I'm going to move forward. Okay? So,
permission granted.
Thank you very much, Jim. So one of the things that has been discussed is they kind of work together is what's the background of the river and what should be the background cleanup standards. And, you know, in my layman's interpretation, that it's hard to clean something up to a cleaner level than what the standard background is. And so picking a background is very important. And then the other part is fish consumption. As many of you know that have read the work that we've done, is that the Park Service comes from the position, as they've explained to me, the National Park Service, that the residents of Washington deserve the same standards as residents of any other citizens in the country in terms of standards. But there's also tempered realities. And we initially, disagreed or did not adopt the Park Service's recommendation. Park Service's recommendation, if I believe, was around 120 grams per day. If I'm correct, if anybody wants to correct that to a different standard. And we came down to 65 grams per day. And then there's other people that are here that say that's too high and unreasonable. And I think that is something we need to discuss so that when we choose what a daily standard is of what people consume, that A, it needs to reflect obviously the level of protection that our citizens deserve, but on the other hand, the reality that we're an urban river. And that we have to be realistic as best we can and not just aspirational. So, who would like to, first off, do I have a representative from Tetra Tech here?
Yes.
Mark, can you sit up here next to me? I'm not going to ask for a presentation from our tech folks, but what I do want to do is that I know that Mark lives and breathes the draft feasibility study and everything that went into it, and that if I get something wrong, he will either nudge me or correct me. And that's basically around what's been presented. Not right here. And for clarification, Mark, have I misrepresented anything related to those two topics? Okay. So let's discuss. Okay.
I would just generally note that some of us submitting comments also pushed for keeping the higher fish consumption rate.
Why?
Because we feel it's more protective.
Well, it is more protective, but I'm wondering, I know that together as a group with Appleseed, that you hired outside consultants to help test and look at our data. And I really don't mean this to be flip. We all want it to be at the highest level of before the Europeans settled and came over to go down past the river, is what we like. And I don't mean to be flip about that, but in terms of the data being tested of what's possible, is there a representation from you or any of the group that are part of being informed by those experts?
I won't speak for the whole group, although obviously we've had the most direct contact with the consultants. But our original point wasn't just about the precise number, but that we need to be as absolutely protective as possible of the human health, because we know that people are subsistence fishing on this river.
So I'm talking more about saying, you know, I know that we have fishing programs, people fish on the river, but this gets a little bit more to fish consumption. And you're on the river more than anybody in the room except for Jim. And do you have more information that you think would be helpful about what you know about fish consumption of the fishermen that you encounter when you're on the river?
Not quantified.
Anything you want to add, Jim?
Just that it's certainly probably going to be we discussed this years ago, the issue of trying to communicate effectively with people and what are some of our alternatives to people eating fish from the rivers to subsist. And in that, it's hard to say because it's, we could go off in a little bit different direction, but somehow we need to set some level and we need a little bit of science behind it. I don't think we have solid data that says, 1,000 people are eating, a pound a day or something like that. We don't have that. So we're going to, end up kind of pushing for something more protective and, others are going to push for something that they consider more realistic. So I think we're going to have to come to a consensus on this. And I don't mean to be flip about this either at all, but again, how can we, if that is the pressure point in this whole thing, how else can we manage this? I don't mean to be flip at all, but maybe we need to take all the fish out of the river, And I mean, we need to look at it from a perspective of what would you do if you were the CEO of a company or, somebody? How would you protect your employees? How would you protect your family? What is it that you do to reduce that risk? So, maybe there's some other alternatives.
Just for a little bit of background, that the Department of Energy and Environment for D.C. Periodically tests the fish for contaminants that affect human health. And, currently for those that, when we put the results, they're not precise results. We estimate how much the average person can eat per month on the back of our licenses, which again, best deal in the country, $10 for residents, $13 for non-residents, or one of the better growing fisheries in the country. But on the license, it gives an advisory. Now, because it doesn't break out on the license between women of childbearing age or children under six, it has to average it, that it doesn't get that precise. But we do advise that a lot of the fish are edible, but just not on a subsistence level.
With the issue of background, I'm just curious, is that background fish concentration or background sediment concentration? Because I know background sediment concentrations have been raised, but for fish, there is exchange between the Anacostia and Potomac for even non-migratory type fish. But certainly things like striped bass and others, they have a background. So I was not curious as what background was referring to, a fish concentration and a sediment concentration.
Mark?
Well, that we do have a background for fish concentration, and Rebecca, correct me if I'm not speaking here, but this, we have the background for the FS was the upper Anacostia, the non-tidal river, for fish. Yes.
comment on that, and I need to refresh my memory on this Fred Hinckley Fish and Wildlife. I want to look at that very carefully because there's different size fish in the Upper Anacostia, there's different species, and I doubt if you would see in the Upper Anacostia a large blue catfish.
For clarification on that point, by upper we mean non-tidal?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yes. Whenever I refer to Upper Anacostia, I mean the non-tidal river, as opposed to above the CSX bridge or something. Refer to that. The upper is non-tidal, upper 82.
Thank you.
Any other information you want to provide, because this is part of what you know that we'll be looking at in terms of the rod. Yes.
Can I ask a question which maybe very stupid? How do you have a standard that is grams per day consumption that doesn't take into account whether or not it's a bottom dwelling fish or a fish that's regularly comes in from safer areas, et cetera, et cetera? How does all that take into account?
Well, first, Mark will answer that, but let me say, don't assume safer areas. I mean, just the way it plays out is pretty interesting. The rock fish, the striped bass, I believe are getting a lot of their PCBs wherever they're dining between here in Georgia or here in New York, and that their levels are higher in some ways than some of our resident fish. But also maybe the nature of where the striped bass are in the food chain as well. I mean, there's people here that know a lot more than I do. But Mark, your answer.
Yeah, and there's many ways to do this, the math, but the way that we considered consumption was that, first of all, subsistence fishermen were the most vulnerable, and that's what we based our calculations on. And the assumption we made is that if you're a subsistence fisherman, you're gonna keep what you catch. You're not gonna target blue catfish over, you know, if you catch a large mouth of bass, you're gonna keep that. If you catch some other fish, that you're more likely to keep that. So we didn't try to differentiate between different kinds of fish.
Okay. Did you include striper in that palette of fish? Although we're telling people to keep them, people are going to keep eating them.
Rebecca,
they're a star trophy fish, not only for trophy catching, but also for consumption.
So the basis of the human health risk assessment for the Anacostia River was the fish consumption advisory data collected in 2013. They did not include the striped bass.
So I've personally asked this body several times when we were going to include the striper data with which the District Department of Energy and Environment closed consumption of striper. Mm-hmm. Why was that good enough to issue a do not eat, a very politically unfavorable do not eat, which I was proud of the district and applaud the district for doing, and it's not good enough to be included in the study when we're talking about human health?
I think primarily because it's an anadromous fish and that they spend majority of their time out of here. And so in terms of them being an indicator of the level of contaminants, especially PCBs and Anacostia, they're not a good indicator fish. So what Mr. Pinkney was talking about is if we're using background and there's two things here. One is the background, and the striped bass, my understanding, are not a good indicator fish for background. The other thing, of course, we're talking about is how much we expect it to eat and how much risk are we willing to take in terms of people getting cancer. But in terms of a background fish, it's not, if I got this right, it's not a background fish for the Anacostia.
Right, it's highly mobile. And in my opinion, there are some striped bass that are sort of more homebodies, and perhaps some of those fish that were high, the striped bass,
maybe spending a lot of time in an urban area, not necessarily D.C., but maybe 15, 20 miles stretch near D.C., but it's unknown.
It looked at Strike Bass a lot on the Delaware River, and, you know, with their lifestyle, they've come into the estuaries to spawn and reproduce, so that's where, I mean, they basically have, they have some background even through the eggs and, you know, the reproduction process, but then you can monitor whether they're gaining or losing. Sometimes the fish concentrations change when they move into different areas. So it's a little bit more complex with a species like that. I mean, they're a very desirable fish, so, you know, their background is their background, their accumulation is their accumulation type of thing, but it's going to be specific. Based on what you said, its role, its status in the food chain, whether it's a bottom dweller, whether it's a pelagic fish, you know, not all fish are the same. But you know, their accumulation is generally the same in some ways, and that's based on the amount of lipids in their bodies.
Well, it is one of those fish that we do put tags on, not tags, but trackers on. And so we do know, as you know, you have that data. We share that data together. We do know that they travel quite well, maybe not every fish. But we also know that blue cats, channel cats, bullheads, and some of the others travel a lot less and are probably a little bit better as an indicator of the uptake into the, you know, bioaccumulation food chain or related to the Anacostia River itself.
So I guess I need some clarification, because I wasn't aware that we were strictly talking about fish as a background. I thought we were also talking about fish tissue. For
instance,
for the 120 or 65 grams a day, we're talking about what's going to go into the model to dictate where we need to get. Is that false?
No, that's true. Just in terms of not letting one necessarily, if it's a variable that's not helpful for one part of this and they're intricately tied together, make it difficult to base it on determining whether the Anacostia is the reason. Now, when you're talking about the sediment remediation, we of course want all of our region to clean up enough so that regional fish can be edible by all of us. But in terms of the degree of sediment remediation, it just may be helpful to use a different indicator fish.
I disagree, because the striper, I mean, you used that data to close a fishery. So that data got your attention. That data was acted upon pretty swiftly, but only after you spent an additional year getting that whole other set of data. So clearly the district found that data worthwhile.
Well, yeah.
So I don't understand why that data will now be excluded from the palette of fish tissue concentrations which we need to get to.
I'll let our experts speak to that, Sonia.
Well, I think, you know, there's a desire to protect striped bass from an ecological perspective too, in terms of them being able to reproduce and stuff. But I just wanted to mention, like for something like a blue catfish, what Jim mentioned, and this has been done in some areas, like blue catfish are an invasive species and they cause a lot of ecological damage. So there could be some management things done before, like put a bounty on them. If you turn them into, you know, you can catch and get paid for type, get them out of the system type of thing. That's been done for things like carp or other long-lived species that accumulate a lot of stuff. But those are some of the species that really accumulate a lot of, that you don't want people eating. And you don't even really want them in your ecological system as well, because they eat all the shad, they eat all the, a lot of more than native fish.
Fred?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think ultimately you're going to do something with the sediments and incoming water that we've seen. Part of, basically, the two sources to the fish are the water and the sediments, and then the smaller fish that are eaten by the bigger fish, and the smaller fish are getting it from the sediments or the water. So I think the goal, yes, is to clean up the fish, but you're going to do that by protecting other media. So it's very good to set a realistic goal
And the goal is over some time we'll have less consumption advisories, which for most species, those are becoming less restrictive as they go. So I think on a volume basis, there I'm sure are a lot less striped bass being eaten by fishermen along the Anacostia than there are the other species that are more local. And I would also say, I don't know, Rebecca, did you look at the most recent fish tissue, the 2018 report? Okay. Okay. I'm pretty sure that's been released. 2017 and 2018 data. But I think maybe, Tommy, you want to talk with people in the department and see if calculations need to be refined with that newer data set.
Yep. Gretchen, is there anything you want to say about that? Gretchen?
She's working on that phone issue.
Oh, okay. Okay, Natalie, is there anything you want to say about that?
No, we'll check. I'm not sure what other parts of the agency have, but I'll make sure
that.
Jim? To Trey's point, though, when we did put the do not eat striped bass advisory out, it was really because we didn't know where it was coming from, because they do migrate. So we really didn't know. We just knew that people shouldn't be eating them. That's why we did it. So to be able to use that in comparison to say, you know, and that's been the subject of what we're trying to tie fish contamination with sediment contamination here at the river. And so, you know, I don't think that it's completely one-to-one comparison.
Right.
So I think it informs the environment that you're looking at.
Okay. Walter?
Yeah, just building on the conversation you're just now having, can you tell us, Tommy, a bit more about how and when you think there's going to be additional fish data taken into account in your process?
There's two sets of data. We're going to always be collecting more fish, because we have to do fish advisories with the Department of Health. But the other set of data is, Fred, you want to say anything about the Munchak study trying to look at a fish that's fairly fast growing, but yet is fairly localized?
Yeah, so these are fish that about 2 inches long, mummy chugs and banded killifish. They're much more stationary, so you can get more site-specific information. So obviously they're not fish that people are eating, but they'll give you a better idea of how concentrations vary throughout the watershed. And we have some data that we collected last fall, and we should be getting the lab results very soon.
Okay, and so we're going to continue. So Walter, did that answer your question at all?
Yes, yeah, sort of. So, but you don't have kind of a schedule in mind. New data is going to become available, and you're going to take that into account in the draft FS or in the ROD going forward?
Well, I don't know how much the new data would skew it one way or the other, because a lot of data has been collected, and there's other factors involved. So I'm not sure one snapshot or one study necessarily changes the whole thing. I know that, for example, Park Service has had expectations about what users of water bodies around their parks should be able to expect. That probably is not going to change. Now, the other side is we do have data on about how many folks eat fish out of the river. We've done, you know, a survey on that. And so, so we base somewhat in science, but we don't see that there's going to be something fully an outlier. We're just going to pretty, anybody else can add to this, but it's basically truing up the data each time we get more information. Mark?
Yeah, I was just going to say that in the FS, we, after the rod is placed, whatever type of rod that might be, the
we would baseline fish concentrations and continue, we would establish long-term monitoring that would use that as a metric to see how we're doing. And that could embrace other technologies like passive sampling as an analog for fish tissue and things like that to try to see how the trends are going. So it's the data will inform the process as we go forward.
It can be accommodated in the rough. Back to you, Trey, I catch up.
So am I correct in understanding that there will be any striper data will be excluded from how we assess success with this project?
I don't know how much the striper data informs the level of PCBs, the standards for the sediment, because the stripers are such that we may be testing the full regional environment by testing the stripers. By looking for fish that are more attached to the area along the Anacostia River, it doesn't exclude the stripers at all. It just is a better indicator of what is coming out of this. I mean, stripers will benefit from whatever standard we set.
Yeah, I look forward to happier stripers, but what I remain concerned with is a subsistence angler. Are we only going to look at the hypothetical subsistence angler who was magically not consuming striper? Or are we going to look at the risk to the subsistence angler, which is a realistic one, who is consuming striper, regardless of where it comes from?
So if we say that we need to remediate the sediment to a certain level for stripers, and we know that they're picking up PCBs outside of the Anacostia, it is, I have no idea if there's any relationship to the amount of PCBs found in stripers, then I do know there's relationships with fish that don't travel. So there's no saying we're going to exclude stripers from the benefits of remediating the environmental parts that they live in when they're here. But frankly, at one point our data said that the local fish were getting healthier, the stripers were getting worse. The only way to explain that is the time that they spent away from that Anacostia River. Otherwise, it's not logical. Unless there's something about the way they feed that's different, that they have greater susceptibility here than elsewhere, I don't know. But the experience that we're having tracking stripers is not the same as the other fish. So to base it on a fish that is not tracking the same as the local fish, would pass doubt on the standards that we set for the...
So I disagree that the fish is not the end goal. The concentration in fish, whatever the basket we set as the hypothetical consumption basket is not the end goal. That is a step towards the risk to human health.
Okay.
And the toxins in the stripers, regardless of where they're coming from, are coming into those resistance angles. And so they don't need to be considered when we're talking about the risk to human health.
Okay. Simeon, yeah. You were next, Matt, sorry.
And I know we're running out of time on this subject, but what are the implications of the National Park Service 120 grant? Is that now history, or is that something we're going to have to contend with now?
All right.
I think that that was sent to you all for your consideration, and I'd like to, the Park Service would like to hear some feedback on that number and how you came to your number.
Okay, Simeon?
Yeah. So going back to the sediment and like new fish data maybe not changing the picture much in terms of fish tissue concentration, I would say that the mummy trout data, which is more localized, more tied to the sediment, that may be more valuable in terms of sediment remediation decisions than other species. So like you said, setting a sediment standard river-wide for a striped bass, there's a lot of uncertainty in that. But if you know that you have mummy chogs in your, you know, in a certain area, you know pretty much that they're getting their load from that settlement. So you can start determining where in the watershed they're getting higher levels of, you know, from the settlement.
Absolutely, and that's why that study's so important. You're absolutely right. That'll help us true up that even better. Fred?
Yeah, just from a mathematical point of view, and maybe the DC Fisheries people could verify how often they've seen people on the shoreline eating stripers. But I know from the survey that I was involved in, they had difficulty collecting stripers, so that the striper sample was based from the lower Potomac. We divide the river into a lower upper Potomac and a lower and upper Anacostia, and the composite sample, there was just one in the last round, and that was from the lower Potomac. But we're not talking something that's 20 times what the concentration is in the channel catfish or carp. I have to, you know, I think once the report is released, people can look at the differences in the data and see if you're talking, I don't think you're changing the number very much.
Right. That's my understanding as well. Steve, right?
Yes, Steve Jowitz. I just wanted to note that in terms of following the National Contingency Plan and EPA policy, what you're talking about doesn't make sense. You're trying to look at what people are actually eating, what's a reasonable collection of fish that people are eating in terms of exposure assumptions. And EPA has found that that a lot of migratory fish are bad indicators of either existing site conditions or remedy success. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense in that regard. They also are clear that background levels in fish or background levels of risk shouldn't be used in making remediation decisions, even though it may be something that does feed into informing the public. And I think that's exactly what you're saying.
You're close. Thank you, Eric. Just a couple of comments. Regarding the consumption rate, I think as we've said in our comments before a number of times, I think our position is that 65 grams per day, we think there's reasons to question whether that is plausible in the Anacostia River. We've heard people acknowledge today that there really isn't any site-specific survey data to back up the impressions that people have that it's higher than that. And frankly, that's the kind of thing that we would advocate should be looked at more carefully in before making mediation decisions. And likewise, with regard to the additional sampling, I'm not sure. I'm interested that there seems to be reluctance to share more recent sampling data, and in particular, reluctance to consider more recent sampling data in this whole RFS process. And I think that's just another example of why EPCO's position has been for a long time that we don't really have data today to decide what our final cleanup standard is and what our final cleanup action should be. And we should instead start with things that make sense to do now and collect and evaluate the additional data before we make this decision.
One way to read that is we started something, I'm not asking you to endorse 65 grams per day, we started something like that. Does not include us getting to a higher standard as we go forward and remediate the river, that it doesn't say we now have this, we can't exceed it. And that's kind of what, am I interpreting that's what you're saying?
No, regarding the fish consumption center, that has a significant impact on cleanup and how much cleanup needs to be done. And the difference between 65 and 35 is hundreds of millions of dollars potentially. So I think it seems to us that before making decisions of that magnitude, we ought to have better information about what we think the subsistence angler exposure really is.
Got it? I'm going to stay with this group. So if you have a representative here, go through your representative. Otherwise, I won't be able to manage the whole thing.
Well,
What can I just say? I think we agree with Eric that you should collect the best data you can, and as more data become available to help you make the best judgment you can, you should continue to do that. But I would like to underscore a point that Trey made a minute ago. In the end, you're going to have to make a judgment call. And we think you should err on the side of protecting human health in whatever standard you adopt.
Right. Right. Now, it's not like there's no data. I mean, there's been surveys, and you know this was not plucked out of the air. But also, even with surveys, I know that the Park Service took that into consideration when they came out with their standard, that it wasn't, this is what you should be able to get, you know, at Yellowstone. I don't know if you fish there. But it was a standard based on some survey work that was done. So it's not just, wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that where the 65 came from was there were, have been a number of surveys, but only one done back and been done a while ago, but it actually involved measuring what people, talking to people, finding out what they ate. I think it was based on hard data, where the other surveys did not have as, where it weren't as data-based, if I could use that term. So that's why, that's where the 65 comes from. And it's the best number for our area, as opposed to other estimates that we made. And that's why we went with that, based on data.
Okay, this has been robust. I think everyone understands the issue of what we're working with, and our commitment's got to be data-based. And so with that, let's move on to ongoing sources of operable units. Ongoing sources, my understanding would be that it's recontamination, that and anyone can correct me along the way, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to clean up an area that you know is going to be recontaminated and is being recontaminated after you cleaned it up. And so we've got, except for maybe two sites, at least two, we still have PCBs flowing into the river. And we have committed that we need to get that cleaned up before we start taking action. Now, I know that in particular that our river advocates, and we're all river advocates, but in particular the ones that we designated for river advocates, that's a source of frustration, that you have expectations about river cleanup. We can come up with any standard, that'd be great, but if it doesn't start cleaning up because we still have recontamination coming in, then it's somewhat pointless for our generation. And so we can say that we know that the recontamination is happening, that we're working closely with Prince George's County regarding the recontamination that we know is coming from Beaver Dam Creek, Lower Beaver Dam Creek. And we've had more data now that shows kind of the flow that is coming in. I want to see if anybody wants to speak or add to that, because that was one of the things in our matrix, is recontamination. Right.
Is there somebody here that can speak to that additional information you referred to?
Which?
The, like what you just said about Lower Beaver Dam, the additional information about the flow.
So there's two levels. And first level is that, and you can ask any questions about that you want. It kind of goes to what Trey was talking about in the last meeting, is what is the level, what is recontamination agents, the level of recontamination? Is it something that is so light that if you did clean up, that it'd be 30 years from now that we got anywhere near 50 years or 100 years to the current level of contamination? Or is it heavier flow? And I don't mean to paraphrase, but you drew it into the question, what does recontamination mean? And then the second question is where is it coming from? How do you know? So that, Gretchen, I don't know who the person is best to speak to that, but I'll start with Mark.
Yeah, Mark would be best. You can summarize.
Yeah, there was a preliminary study done, sampling done in 2016, 2017. It was about a year-long effort samples collected by the USGS, and very carefully measured suspended sediment coming in, and discharge. And the basically the three largest streams are Northeast, Northwest Branch, and Lower Beaver Dam Creek. The Lower Beaver Dam Creek is punching way above its weight in terms of, I mean, it's a distant third in terms of water flow and, sure, and sediment flow into the river. But Lower Beaver Dam Creek has a much greater mass flowing rate because of its contamination sources in that watershed. I think, I don't remember without going back to the FS on in front of me, but it might be a healthy, a large percentage of the loading is coming from that, from Lower Beaver Dam Creek. There is some coming from Northeast Branch and less from Northwest. That's
right. Yeah, we just saw the presentation by Dr. Wilson on Monday. Mm-hmm. So he has, as far as PCB load from the tributaries, 85% or so was coming from Lower Beaver Dam Creek. But in terms of flow, it's 14% of the flow. So you could kind of make the case that if you could clean up Lower Beaver Dam Creek, the sediments actually coming from northeast to northwest, which is most of the flow, or cleaner, that would actually help to clean the system.
It would, but the issue.
Well, what I just wanted to add one thing is that, you know, in our next meeting, if we want to have, Dr. Wilson was actually at our last meeting. So if we want to ask him to come, and maybe Dr. Ghosh, who was the principal investigator of the Muscle and Passive Sand Water study, then we can ask them to come. We were at MDE on Monday, and they saw these presentations. And it was
so helpful. Is that our process, just to be clear to everyone, that the way I would prefer to do it is that if we have a study that with data that we're basing any of our opinions on, that we get that information out to you right away. And then if we bring in the authors of the study, it will be for them to answer questions and not to present. That we're passing through this so that we get study out to you as fast as possible and you determine how you want to get that information presented to you. You may even get the principals to come present to your groups or to meet with you. But don't look to us to get the presentation to you. Or have a in-person presentation, but we will bring in this resource after we get the data out there.
No, I think the issue here is not whether or not we need to deal with Beaver Dam Creek. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Those numbers in the 80s have been kicking around for months now. The question is, where's this stuff coming from? And I'm not hearing any clear answers. You know, the county says, well, you know, we got some problems up there. In the upper part of the watershed where we built the subway stations and stuff like that. And then you get in your car and you drive off Eastern Avenue and it blows you away how much crap is lying around the lower part of Lower Beaver Dam Creek. It's just recycle center after recycle. You know, one person's recycle center is another person's dump. But the piles of abandoned appliances, the piles of used cars are just incredible in there. And you can't drive through three blocks without saying to yourself, this is not, you know, this is not really super science here. Let's get to work, guys.
So frame that issue, it will have to be considered in one way or another within the rod and the expectations of feasibility and how we clean up. So just to frame it, it will have to be I have to consider it right.
Okay. So we started this conversation off of this section pretty well. Your summary of my point last week was perfectly appropriate, but we've gotten distracted the same way we started out getting distracted last meeting, which is by what's coming in. And I haven't seen any documentation yet quantifying even vaguely the relationship between what's coming in and what's already here.
Okay. That's why we got Mark here. Mark,
to the best we're working on. We will get you that number. I apologize, it's not available yet, but it's just getting the number out of the model, which is happening as we speak.
So, Mark, can you frame the question in a way that so everybody understands what the question is that you're answering?
I think in the last meeting, the statement was made that 98% is coming from the tributaries as opposed to the other potential, the MS4s and the CSSs, et cetera. And the question was, okay, whatever that amount of PCBs is, how does that relate to what's present in that top 6 inches of river bottom all over the 9 miles of study area? I mean, is it, 10%, 1%, 50%? Because that, you need that context to know, is that source, what does it mean in terms of what we already have? And so that's why we want to quantify that. I'd like to get it out of the model, make sure the models, we have a consistent answer with the model, because I think the model is the key to understanding this system. And we'll get that number to you.
Thank you. We'll get the number to everyone.
I do want to, one little comment on that. The mass of material, whether it's in the top 6 inches or elsewhere, versus what's coming in and in the water column, is not an apples to apples comparison. And I think, as it's either Fred or Simeon said earlier, the fish can be affected by a lot of different compartments in the ecosystem. If what's coming down the tributaries and in the water column, that may be affecting the fish tissue concentrations more, relative, more than you would think, relative to what's in the top 6 inches of sediment or the top inch of sediment, the current exposure pathway. So there's just a lot of unknowns. I think a lot of comments have pointed out that the actual contributions of COCs from all these compartments to today's fish tissue is not really locked in. So there's a lot of uncertainty there, and I would just caution everyone to stay away from generating numbers that aren't relevant to the risk picture and the remediation picture, because it's about trying. The issue about what's coming in from the tributaries is important if you're trying to set a cleanup number that's lower than that background. So that's really something that
that's not really a background. That's a other contaminated level.
And just to be clear, that that I understand that there will be uncertainty, and we have to accommodate that, but that won't prevent us from getting to a rod. Jim?
I'd just like to say that I think that this gives us another great opportunity for some early action in Lower Beaver Dam to investigate and try to reduce the ongoing contamination there. And that I'd like to recommend that we maybe move that up even to as a bit more of a priority as a group, that we perhaps look for a solution that may not point to the specific problem. So, for instance, maybe we could consider having some sort of sediment trap built into the channel there to capture sediment before it comes into the river and mine it from there, whether we understand, but if something like that, maybe it's some other heavier assessment further back up into there. But I think that we're going to end up with not being able to understand that the PCBs in this sediment over here came from Lower Beaver Dam specifically, and that becomes an issue that we will debate.
So I'm going to park that for a little bit, like probably in our next agenda item after we dispose of this one, and that's the use of a sediment trap as one of the remediation possibilities. Let me just park that for a minute. So also on ongoing sources, there's the issue of suboptimal units. If anyone want to speak in opposition or for suboptimal units, or explain why that would be an issue for you, Steve?
We're coming at this from the perspective of Washington Gas, one of the entities that have been specifically identified as a suboperable unit. Washington Gas has been working for some years implementing a consent decree that it entered into requiring work doing remediation work in the upland area and investigating the sediments adjacent to the facility. And that consent decree imposes a lot of requirements on Washington Gas, and we've been diligently moving ahead with the investigative requirements of that legal agreement. And we have to define the nature and extent of contamination in those sediments, do risk assessments, and evaluate remedies in a feasibility study that ultimately the National Park Service will be looking at and making a decision. It's a site-specific approach. Our data density is, in fact, a lot higher than the data density in the Anacostia River sediment project. So we think we're in the process of gathering good information about the area in front of the facility, and we're using, in the context of that work, a background area that's some distance upstream in the river. So that's the context for how we look at this suboperable unit question, is how they get factored in. What we think makes the most sense and is consistent with our legal obligations is letting that RIFS process continue independently of the Anacostia River process, such that all of the time and energy and resources that have been invested and will continue to be invested in the Washington Gas East Station work aren't rendered pointless by some decision imposed on that area from information analysis actually relating to a much broader area. We don't speak for PEPCO or the Navy. We'd be surprised if they didn't have similar views, and I think they've provided comments consistent with that notion. So the real question is for DOEE is, what do you intend to do? Will you allow the site-specific work to stand and count, or do you have some other vision of the future that we really need to understand, because we're under obligations to do things, and we want to make sure that those things will count.
So if I understand what you're asking, kind of going to the end, and tell me if this is just a non sequitur, but that'll tell me that I don't understand what you're asking. But if I understand what you're asking, is let's say that through all your work and through your negotiation with the Park Service, that you come to a very stringent standard. You agree to it, go to a stringent standard, and say, subject to ongoing monitoring. But you've got to keep it at that standard too. And then the sites on both sides of you come to a less stringent standard. And we know from hydrology that there's some exchange of material during different large rain events, that they will continue to keep you under your goal because they agreed to it and were able to get a lower standard. So that would render you on the hook by default, in some ways, potentially depending on the hydrology, eventually cleaning up their two sites by continuing to remediate yours. Is that part of the kind of confusion that you're talking about could happen?
No, not really.
Okay.
The issue is we're doing a site-specific analysis, including site-specific risk assessments. We're not a PCP site, and it is inappropriate to have standards that may be applied across the river for other constituents to force any particular amount of cleanup or remedial alternatives for the Washington Gas East Station operable unit 2. We think that remedy decision should be based on the facts and analyses specific to that site. There is the question of what does it mean if other constituents come into that area, but that should not be an issue for our site. I do want to note, as a general matter, this relates to the recontamination issue we were discussing earlier, that overall, the levels of constituents in the sediments, all constituents, not just PCBs, are going down over time. In shallower sediments, the shallower sediments are cleaner than the deeper sediments. The river is recovering. That's a very important point. And as Gretchen suggested, if the contributions from upstream sources are addressed, that natural recovery will accelerate. And it's important to understand these things before decisions that involve costs of hundreds of millions of dollars are made in a permanent kind of way, because once you make decisions about those issues, they're very hard to undo. But I want to return to our specific issue, which is what we're looking for with this suboperable unit concept is the ability to get a suboperable unit specific consideration. So if you treat those areas as independent areas subject to their own procedures and analyses, then you're respecting those existing obligations and the conditions at that site that are being analyzed in tremendous detail.
So I want to be sure everybody's on track in this conversation. Mark, how does that issue impact the draft feasibility study?
I believe what Steve is, if I could correct me if I'm wrong, by being independent, by having an independent analysis, and that the SOUs are independent, that you would set your own cleanup levels. The cleanup levels would not be, those criteria from the ARSP would not apply to the SOUs. Is that basically what you're saying?
Correct. They wouldn't drive the remedy decision at that location. As I mentioned, we're not a PCB site. The PRGs that you published are PCB PRGs. There are PCBs present at low levels in the sediments next to Washington Gas that came from elsewhere. This goes to why setting an extremely low level for a constituent like that has river-wide ramifications.
Well, I'll answer Director's question that, notwithstanding, like, PAH is, I'm not hypothetically, that's a Washington Gas constituent. And there are, you are able to, if other sites are able to go to a higher level, then the river is cleaned up to for PAHs, then they could become hotspots in the future as the rest of the river is cleaned up, and they could be areas of and there could be ramifications to that. So that's a concern if the rest of the river cleans up to a lower number. It kind of calls into question what we're able to accomplish for the larger ARSP. Okay, Jim.
I just want to point out that the work that we're doing here in the room today is not under a consent decree. We're trying to do it in a voluntary manner. And it's really to define and connect the sites that do have consent decrees. What we've learned since we started is that there's ongoing contamination that does impact those. Maybe a year or so ago, we started talking about, well, what does this mean for each of those sites? And that's how we came to the operable units discussion, because we are looking at sediments in the river going, well, are we contributing or are they contributing to us? So it is a delicate balance, but without a kind of command and control of the consent decree, like at the Navy Yard, for instance, where they are setting stuff more, we're trying to come to agreement together on what those issues are. If you don't have a PCB issues, then perhaps, as we look at, where are you going to excavate to into the river? That's one of the questions. And so, how do we, or if you ask me excavate, how far do you go? Where do you own to? That's part of what we're trying to discover here.
I'll come back to Steve for that.
Yeah, this goes back to my earlier question about the Park Service, which I'm still confused about. You mentioned the Park Service in your comment. Are you suggesting that certain parts of the river should be reduced to this higher Park Service number, and that other parts of the river not be? Because if that's the case, I think we got a lot to talk about. So I'm really somewhat confused about whether or not you're suggesting lesser effort necessarily.
It's not a matter of hires.
It would like to be much lower standard.
Do you answer that question, Steve?
Sure. Yeah, it's not a matter of lesser effort or greater effort. It's a matter of trying to have consistent with the National Contingency Plan and the Superfund Law, which is the framework not only for our site-specific work, but the Anacostia River Project. It should be science-based and data-based. We're generating a lot of data in connection with our area. And it's not just about cleanup levels. It's about other things being looked at for the larger river, like sedimentation rates and the viability of various remedial technologies. We don't want some decision made with respect to the entire river to drive something that doesn't actually fit our site. It's not tailored to our site. We know those, you know, we're really looking at those conditions in tremendous detail.
Okay, Trey.
So, understanding your concerns, at the same time, your waterside site is part of the entire river. Right? It's really that simple. I mean, there's not a magical boundary where fish hit an underwater invisible wall and that cross between the area of the river immediately adjacent to your waterside portion of your site and the actual waterside portion of your site. So respecting that you did not generate, to my knowledge, PCBs on your site, but that PCBs are present, that's moot for the point of how we clean up. Where that comes into play is how the various potentially responsible parties exchange funds into the cleanup fund. That doesn't deal with how the river gets cleaned up. That deals with how y'all decide to parcel out the costs after that cleanup decision is made.
We're doing a lot of work relating to risk assessment locally. If you're suggesting that that is all going to be rendered pointless, then I'm troubled, very troubled.
No, not at all. I think that the site-specific work, which has been going on, and much of it for way longer than it was ever intended to go, according to the original court documents, I think that that detail of work, that depth of work, is valuable. I think that's part of how the district has been able to accelerate this project. So this, again, this remains one of the quickest projects of this scale, scope, and nature, to my knowledge, in the history of this kind of work. And I think a lot of the district's success with that is on the backs of the site-specific work. And the value of that work should not be rendered null and void. That value, intellectually and financially, should be considered in how those costs are allotted coming out, the same way that I expect the district's investment in the RIFS process for the ARSP will be dealt with when y'all are exchanging who pays for how much in the final cleanup. So I'm not at all suggesting that the work is null and void. I think it should be valued very highly. But as far as what we're talking about for the FS, for the ARSP, so long as what your findings push for a cleanup on your specific site are not less stringent than what the overall thing comes out to, that might be something worth talking about. But perhaps it would be better to just let the larger project go forward, educated by your work. But I don't think that site-specific things, like there's PCB in our sediment and we don't produce that, needs to affect the river-wide sediment project, and it certainly cannot affect it to the detriment of the overall quality of the finished product.
I'll come back to Eric. Simeon?
So, my understanding is that you have suboptimal units, and then you have the PECSs, which are suboptimal.
The what?
The PECSs. That's the term in the...
The PECS stands for Potential Environmental Cleanup Site.
Which would be like Washington Gates, right?
There's 15 PECSs all over the river, and they have to be, they're one of them.
Okay, so there is a distinction. The suboperable units are bigger than the PECS.
No, the they have to be a PECS and have the distinction of being a suboperable unit.
Okay, the point is, and it was mentioned earlier, Tom, you mentioned there's a functional background number in terms of active sediment remediation, something you're going to do in the short term. And there's an attribution factor in the NCP that has to be considered. But from the last conversation, it seems like doing these kind of maybe hotspot or PECS type cleanups would be an important adaptive management component
to a longer term goal of reaching maybe lower sediment numbers river wide, which would be influenced by a lot of more passive or natural attenuation type functions, as Gretchen mentioned. And we've already been seeing that over time. Contamination levels coming into the system are lower. If you can clean up lower Beaver Dam Creek or something, they'll even be lower. But it's a matter of timing. It's a matter of active versus passive sediment. It's a matter of cost. It's a lot of things. But I would certainly be a proponent and have been that some of these more active cleanups at targeted sites should occur faster than later. And that's more of the Superfund model.
Eric? Thank you, Mr. Ross. A couple of points. First of all, HECO is also one of the sub-affordability sites identified. And like Washington Gas, we've spent years and many millions of dollars studying our under assumptions, frankly, that have changed a lot over that period of time from what we all pursued at the beginning. So be it. We're not prepared to disregard the legal framework within which all this happens. We're prepared. We signed a consent decree. We're complying with a consent decree. We'll continue to comply with a consent decree. That doesn't mean that we are going to accept a cleanup standard aside from the entire river. We think it's not appropriate. And we'll have to deal with that and within that legal framework of the time. Simeon, I'm sorry you weren't here last meeting because we agree with the comments you just made. And unfortunately, we seem to get no traction on that in our last discussion about the way to properly sequence these things. And as we said before, if work done at some of the SOUs could be part of an adaptive management strategy, I think there's opportunity for a lot of consensus around that. If on the other hand, a river-wide evaluation, which we think is notwithstanding the time and effort and good work that's been done, frankly, is not ready for prime time for a river-wide remedy. If that gets thrust upon us, that's a whole different story. So I just want to make sure that's clear from Pepco's point of view. And the other thing I would say is, to Simeon's point, I'd like to think that at the end of the day, we're going to, when the time comes to clean up the river, we're going to recognize that what matters are average concentrations, particularly for fish that have home ranges that are a few feet. And so a cleanup standard in one area doesn't have to be exactly the same as a cleanup standard everywhere else in order to achieve something and hopefully accomplish our goal.
For clarification, Eric, are you saying that Petco will be setting a standard for its cleanup goals for the sediment in front of the Petco site? Will there be a standard?
Well, honestly, we're still in the process of working through that. We're finishing up our RI. We're initiating work on the feasibility study, and I don't really want to negotiate about all that in this context. But my expectation is, yes, at some point there will be some sort of a remedial program that comes out of our site-specific FS, and it will include some kind of standards.
Right. So that's important to know, that you anticipate there will be a standard rather than no standard, just see how much better it gets, but there will be guided by a standard. That's important to know.
Well, as we talked about at the last meeting, I think even if you don't decide what you think your final standard needs to be, that doesn't mean that there aren't criteria that you would use to guide what you want to do in terms of no reaction. So, at the end of the day, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't know how the Petco site is going to fit within the larger framework here, but ultimately, I wouldn't disagree with you that the Superfund process we're working through will require some standard to be identified.
Right.
I'd like to point out that going back to the last meeting's adaptive management discussion, If the suboperational units become places that can accelerate the work, which I think is where Simeon was going with some of his conversation, if that's actually what happens, that would be amazing. Absolutely amazing. But what we've seen so far from the suboperable units is a consistent history of missed court deadlines for the project. So if that's something that those sites are prepared to actually do and make sure that it's faster, if not at least better, but at least faster than the overall ARSP work, then I think that would be absolutely amazing. But so far, we don't have confidence in that.
Just real quick, Matt, in terms of like some super fun terminology, too, I would stay away from the word standard. That kind of sounds like water quality standards. And Superfund, they use like preliminary remediation goals, remedial action goals,
right.
And they're site specific. Okay, so that's a difference. I mean, they're not like water quality standards that you apply over a whole building. They're site specific remedial action levels.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And that's a very good point, Eric.
Thank you, Richard. For the record, I have to say, using our RI is taking longer than anticipated is because we're doing a ton of work. We're doing, and everything we have done, the court has agreed it makes sense for us to take additional time. So I don't want anyone to think that somehow PEPCO is violating court orders or dragging its feet. Nothing to do with it.
The same is true for Washington Gas. One of the reasons the schedule is what it is because we are often asked to go out and gather additional information by either the Park Service or DOE.
One last comment. Perhaps Lower Beaver Dam should be a suboptimal unit, and then we could work through BECSs through there, and that would help us understand and drive this.
You know, the degree that it could be, and I don't know, in terms of the DEC's jurisdiction, but I will say that there's two roles for the Mayor's Leadership Council. One is to bring everyone together to do things like work on Lower Beaver Dam Creek. We're right now hijacking this group for now. We're kind of odd. This is the appropriate group, but it's not on the, I mean, how we fashion the ride to incorporate Lower Beaver Dam Creek and then still continue to be Maryland and George's and the cleanup of Lower Beaver Creek. In some ways, there's kind of a procedural difference, but it doesn't mean it's not a priority. So, so Simeon, was your hand up? Was there someone else I missed? Steve.
Sure, I want to agree with Simeon that these are site-specific cleanup standards that we're looking for. Use the term remedial action goals, preliminary remediation goals. The other thing, it's not just about cleanup standards, I think I mentioned earlier, it's about understanding what remediation approaches best suit the risks presented at the individual site, and those cleanup technologies for Washington Gas East Station may be different. The best remedy decision may be different based on local conditions, site-specific information. And the CERCLA criteria say you're supposed to, in addition to meeting the basic threshold criteria, they're balancing criteria, and you look at short-term effectiveness, long-term effectiveness, implementability, and cost-effectiveness. And so we're trying to do that in the context of all the data we've collected for that site. So what we're asking is for that to be taken into consideration rather than having a feasibility study essentially overlaid on top of everything we're trying to do and kind of moving it. So we look forward to more conversations on this topic. We recognize it's a complicated topic, but it's something we would really like to understand the direction that the district is heading with respect to that issue. Because we want to have something workable for everybody going forward.
First of all, let me say that makes a lot of logical sense. Simeon was right to make the direction. We're talking about PRTs, not standards. I mean, that's exactly right. Some of these are going to be site specific. And
the challenge has always been, how do we, A, not slow down what's already in process when we started this route process? How do we set standards for, let's say, an area like the catcher's mitt? Is that catcher's mitt right there?
The catcher's mitt is the area in my Navy Yard.
So any common areas where there's an expectation that gets cleaned up, but it's not specifically covered by the one of these other court-ordered actions, is the balance that we have to work together. Now, there's some discussion that, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, that we wait on the general river and let the other sites move forward. Currently, the council of the D.C. government made a different choice by saying, no, we want a river-wide drive, and then put it into law. And so that's not up to debate, because the law is, we're not the council. So how we blend those together so that we don't delay your work, and that we don't waste your money, and that we create expectations so that why these suits or these actions were started to begin with, that we don't undercut the intent of the community members to help push us to do these things. So that's, we may not get it right, but we're going to try. And the interest of the district to meet the expectations of the city's laws, but at the same time, not undermine the work that's already going on. That's the best I can say that. Trey, and then we're going to move to the next agenda.
So I would be curious to see some report outs from the potentially responsible parties about the business sense between keeping things separate and merging things more completely now. Just because, in my mind, not knowing the actual forecasted cost for cleanup, any kind of mobilization on water is typically expensive. So if you're, I would be interested to know the business sense between perhaps accepting more stringent PRGs on your suboperable unit at the benefit of being part of a single large mobilization that allows all of you to leverage the physical resources for cleanup all at once. I'd be interested to know what business sense falls out on either side of that. I don't, honestly don't have a mental picture of how that would balance, but.
Eric, I'll have you give an initial response. I think we think a large mobilization makes no sense whatsoever under any circumstances. I think what makes sense here is a phased approach where the SOUs could be part of that if that's the approach that we've done. Large scale mobilization is justified for really consistent best practices and different sentences.
I'd be interested in seeing the documentation and the support for that.
Well, we've submitted, you can read our, refer to our comments that we've submitted along the way, Trey, and a number of places.
All right, let's slide down to additional technology discussion. Gretchen, you want to help frame, I mean, that's kind of, you created, well, put a couple of things into this one category. Do you want to help frame it?
Well, in our FS draft, we relied on a group of technologies to put together the alternatives. And when at the start of the process, and Mark and Rebecca can jump in here, basically you look at, you know, a larger, longer list of technologies, and then look at the practicality of them within our site, and because some of them are not practical for and don't make it through the screening criteria, then they're not used to come up with the alternatives that we have presented. So what I understood from the themes presented, some of the commenters said, well, we think there's some technologies that you should look at harder, and we would like to bring those up now before we exclude them, you know, kind of for good.
Okay, who'd like to speak to that?
me?
Yeah, I think you stated that. I've been involved in sediment remediation for like too long, 25 years. But it's more than dredging and capping. And Dr. Ghosh is one that I've worked with at DOD sites, and DOD has a lot, but the reactive sediment amendments, and because really you're trying to, as was mentioned earlier, it's not a matter of getting mass out necessarily, it's a matter of reducing exposure, reducing bioavailability. And in some areas where there's shallower depths, like where capping isn't possible, this is an example of some reactive amendment may help there. And generally, those type of techniques can be used to cover larger areas at a lesser cost than what I would call a really active sediment remediation, like dredging or capping. So I did notice that, I can't recall exactly what they were called, thin layer caps, reactive caps, or sediment amendments were screened out, which I think they should be put back in for some areas. Because they have been used in records of decisions. They're not just experimental anymore.
So it's a matter of, Mark, can you speak to that?
Yeah, we agree. And the FS should entertain more thoroughly the carbon-based amendments and so on and so forth. And that they should be looked at, in pilot studies to see if they would be effective. And I think the report is written right now, as you said, is a little too dismissive of them. And that's a change we would make in the next round.
I'm not sure if I was the only one that made that comment, probably others did too.
Okay. That is easy enough.
But we have a related, I don't know if it's what we saw in terms of technologies considered in the FS. One of the options was screened out during the screening portion of the FS and not carried through to a full analysis. That was MS3, which was using the modern was using basically caps of various thicknesses across the rivers as the technology, along with modern natural recovery, and it was screened out on the grounds of implementability, because it was stated in the draft that parts of the main stem are too shallow to accommodate a 6 or 12 inch cap, which raises the question of what about thinner approaches. And it said cap placement would reduce water depths enough to impair future use, and that's based on assumptions made in the FS about what water depth should be. We have a separate comment on that. But if you relook at sedimentation rates, water depths, there was a reference to the usability of objectives and a reference to the National Park Service Organic Act. I note that in the National Park Service's comments on the draft FS, they struck that reference to the Organic Act and really indicated it was about the future use objectives, river usability objectives, that was driving why that was knocked out. Our point is it shouldn't have been knocked out. And we have separate thoughts about both sedimentation rates and the river usability objectives and the recreational boating depth. And at the last meeting, Director Wells, you specifically raised the idea of potentially looking at drafts, recreational boating drafts required. We think that's a good idea, an actual fact-based survey of what the boating drafts are out there. It makes a lot of sense to us. Current water depths are actually sufficient for a lot of the current recreational voting issues. Wanted to note that the 2015 South Capitol Street Record of Decision and EIS, which I'm sure you've looked at, talks about recreational watercraft drafts ranging from a minimum of 1 foot for a small personal watercraft, really don't sink at all, and then to a maximum of 6 feet for a small recreational craft, as well as fire and police boats. And we have anecdotally picked up information about marinas in our area of the river where the maximum draft is less than 5 feet. So that the number thrown out, not thrown out, but proposed in the FS was 15 feet, which is, from our perspective, way in our area of the river, way deeper than it needs to be, or that is really realistic, that makes sense, that's really connected to reasonably anticipated future use. We're also unaware of anybody's plans for doing navigational dredging in that area in order for it really to be wrapped into the reasonably anticipated future use rubric under Superfund. There has to be some reason to believe someone's going to go in there and deal with that outside the remediation dredging concept. So remediation dredging or removal or other remedies is all dealt with based on the criteria for doing that work under CERCLA. So if the district has other goals, that's fine, but they shouldn't be wrapped into the CERCLA context. The CERCLA goals have to be tied to current and reasonably anticipated future uses.
Right, and we agree that the standard is reasonably anticipated use or reasonable use. And take another look at the data from the South Capitol Bridge. We went over it with the Park Service, jointly, and that there's, while they were looking at height, by extrapolating from how much height that they feel like that they learned of the boats going through, you're able to make some assumptions about the depth of those boats. And they came up with us together with, I think, 12 to 15 feet. Now these boats obviously are not generally going to go past the CSX bridge, but when we talk about recreational use, also looking at two other types of boats, the ones that regularly bring passengers to the Nats games in terms of current use, the ones that currently do sightseeing with tourists, and the what's a reasonable size sailboat that's anticipated to be used that are also being used, say, at Yards Park. Your draft is not their draft is not as a motorboat, their draft is their keel. And so we wouldn't want to wipe out a class of boats unintentionally. It would be better to wipe them out intentionally, saying the future use will no longer, we do not anticipate using these boats up here. We just need to be intentional about it. And so that, for example, I see Michael Stevens, that I don't know to what degree, before we foreclose of the investments that are made of what the depth is. I also believe that there's a barge. I see working barges coming up here. I think that their draw is might be greater than 4 feet. So with the working barges that come up, and frankly, Trey, you and Jim see the work, there's a barge that comes up. I don't know if it's the fuel or what. The folks, it'll be good to get, we've got no information from the Navy and no information from Bowling. And the federal users, that do they need, and maybe you have, but we have not received anything from the Navy Yard. Do they ever want to bring a PT boat? Or do they have an anticipated use of what they've preserved their dock to before we knock it out? They should at least tell us. So we've extrapolated from with the Park Service from the same EIS we're talking about for the bridge, but we've not gotten information from the other partners that are not necessarily just recreational use, like barges and those stuff. Like, I know they're rebuilding this bridge using barges. I don't know what they draw. I mean, I need to, but if they're going to rebuild the 11th Street Bridge and use a barge, what's the average depth? It's probably more than 1 to 4 feet.
What we're talking, this is another example of where being more site-specific makes sense. And we're talking in particular about the area in our vicinity where you have a channel that exists today. It's on the order of 10 feet deep.
Right.
And what we're trying to do is have a realistic look at current and future use in that area, because that's the one that may is most relevant to remedy decisions that Washington Gas or remedial alternatives and analysis of alternatives that will be looking
at. So not to be sure about this, but that's the 11th Street Bridge that you're next to. Mm-hmm. And to talk about the recreational use, deciding the depth, it's our job to get more information from DDOT to know that if they need to repair that bridge, and they need to do it from barge or working boat, the recreational use is not going to be helpful to us. Now, I'll put the responsibility back on DC government. We haven't gotten we don't have a good enough data point set for you yet to say that's why, if there's to be repairs on the Love Street Bridge from the water side, or if they're going to build a bridge park or something like that, they do that from the water side. We owe that to you. But to say it's just recreational is not realistic.
Right. There were very broad statements made in the draft about water depths in various stretches. We would strongly encourage a much more specific and detailed discussion of that that allows more localized considerations. And I agree, having DOEE specifically seek more and better information about boating drafts and uses in particular areas makes a lot of sense. We don't speak for the Navy. We've heard that the Navy has no intention of bringing in boats, but if you have a question, ask them specifically and seek a specific answer so you can have that for your record.
And that's in process. Check.
Just very briefly, I also don't want us to unnecessarily and perhaps incorrectly limit ourselves in how to look at depth. First off, just not hitting the bottom is not the only goal. So there are other interactions between vessels and bottom besides physical contact. So avoiding physical contact, yes, is absolutely a goal. We see other conditions besides just high tide. We see low tide. We see things that are way below low tide. This broad, relatively shallow river is highly subject to something called a low tide, where the wind pushes the water level down. So you can go at a high tide, and it's actually lower than what low tide normally is. And that's not an infrequent occurrence. I couldn't tell you exactly how many times it's happened, but I've seen it twice already this year. So there are some other things to be considered besides just mean high water, mean low water, and just, well, how much water does that sailboat need to not scratch the bottom? Especially if you're gonna then turn around on the other side and say, well, let's not dredge, let's cap. You know, we don't want those caps to be disturbed. We don't want those caps to be broken. The caps are, I just say, I understand it, typically cheaper, but one of the things about caps is that caps can get uncapped. Now, once you dredge the material out and remove it, it doesn't come back. Material doesn't.
Got that. So you started with that being screened out. Let's open that back up and ask for clarification from Tetra Tech on screening out MS3.
Well, it was screened out because the what we had to go with in the FS was the depths that DOE made that Steve alluded to in the various stretches of the river. So that was sort of one of the things that one of the parameters we had to run the FS to. And so if we couldn't meet that depth criteria with MS3 because it was just really, it didn't have all the dredging that was needed, so it screened out.
So if you change the criteria to something based on data that is more reasonable or more site-specific, then MS3 could come back in.
It may. I think there was the access issues getting equipment in. The river is very shallow in some places, and where you need to do take some action, you can't get the equipment there, so there would have to be that kind of work.
For clarification, if I remember correctly, we used for the main stem 15 feet?
It was 15 feet from the mouth to the foot of 15th Street, which is up to Washington Gas, and then 8 feet from that point to Bladesburg. And then I think Washington Channel was 20 feet.
It stays at the
24.
Yeah, the navigational.
So I'm committed to a more robust look at this, and also for these site-specific look as well. That I'd be good to know. Generally, bringing folks to the NAS game probably won't be going on the other side of Love Street Bridge, and so. I think you deserve that we need to have a better look at this. I think Trey brings up a very interesting point that we also have to think about is there's low tide, and then to what degree do we look at the unusual low tide? I don't know, but that needs to be a little more robust in that conversation of that. And Trey?
One more thing as I'm fleshing out that definition that I hope we can look at and get data on for depth is also how will the district treat resiliency in this process? A deeper river is better able to respond to flooding events from more frequent, more intense storm events. And how, if we're going to quantify this, which I'm a scientist by training, I support that, but the devil can be in the details. How are we going to quantify resiliency in this process and, giving us better cross-section to the river? The river is artificially much smaller than it ever used to be because of actions of people out of this room. But looking forward, we need to be prepared. The district is very, very low lying and very, very subject to flooding. I think I mentioned last time that there's two little restaurants in Capitol Bid that are down on the deck, just past the two bridge, a different bulb that way. They hadn't been open more than about a month before they were flooded last year. And that wasn't by rain from here, that was by rain from West Virginia, Maryland, from the Potomac that came down and came back up and put us about 3 feet, almost 4 feet above predicted high tide that day. And that's only going to get more frequent, those types of events. So the district, from not only a human health and a property point of view, frankly, some of the places people in the room have property that is subject to some of that flooding. How are we going to incorporate a better cross-section for the river, a better depth for the river, as far as being able to respond to those events?
Okay. That's a good question.
Eric? Just two quick points. Regarding support what Steve said about site-specific analysis, and one thing I can say, regardless of where the navigation depths turn out to be, one of the issues with the FS as it's currently drafted is it looked at this alternative for the entire main stem. If there were areas of the main stem it didn't work, it was rejected altogether. There may very well be areas of superficial contamination that need to be addressed that don't have to be dredged, that are outside of areas where navigation's those technologies could be applied. And it's not unusual to construct remedial packages for different areas of the site from the various technologies that you.
From a layman's perspective, I think that's a very good point about making.
And then last point I would say, I appreciate Trey's concern, but the cleanup process here is not about achieving a better cross-section for the river. That may be a very laudable goal, but that's not what the Superfund program is about. Well, that a factor in considering not making that worse by whatever cleanup we're doing. It's not ultimately an objective of this process.
Jim?
It is, however, part of the NRDA and part of where we expect this all to tie together. So certainly need to look at this holistic system and understand all the pressure points and everything we're trying to do here. From resiliency to sustainability to flow, I think we haven't had a robust discussion about how flow could help us, for instance. So if we're going to stay really narrow into a couple issues that don't take everything into account. We want a sustainable solution that's going to be here for our kids and their kids.
Yeah, and an example is that it doesn't mean that the PRPs are responsible for meeting all the other district goals. But we know that, I think this is just an example, for example purposes. I think there's a berm in front of the channel, down by the wharf, at about 11 feet. It prevents certain boats that they had anticipated and hoped to bring up the channel. That will, the future use on the channel may get to a point where they judge it. In that instance, if we were, for example, capping that, and we knew that within a 5-year, 10-year period, that the money that we spent to cap it, knowing that it's going to be dredged, this doesn't make sense. I'm not saying that's exactly the case. I think that it argues for the site-specific thing that we need to continue to try to figure out. But as you know, we cannot ignore navigation so that we don't waste all of our money on remediation that's going to be torn up. But we can't, I agree, it doesn't apply for across the board of the whole river. You need to look at site-specific, for example.
Just a follow-up question, then. You indicated you were committed to taking a more robust look at site specificity and the specific assumptions. Do you anticipate actually then doing some kind of study, gathering data? And if so,
we're in the process of gathering data. Now we're doing this. We're going to do it in three different ways. One is we currently have a survey out that's gone out to all the marinas. We're trying to get all the users aware of the survey. The survey is out there. We certainly are looking at the data that was looked at the EIS for the South Capitol Bridge. And then we're going to have to walk around the wharf and the boats that we see out here. Maybe grant to the our NGOs that are out here to ask their, what's the draft on the boat that you're looking at. But then we also need to have a better response from our federal partners. What is their anticipated use and need for their sites?
We would encourage as technically robust an approach to gathering data on that topic as possible, to rely less on self-reporting and as much as possible on actually seeing what's there. Something as reliable as possible. When you talk about survey, you're talking about something other than the general survey that was done earlier. You're talking about a specific survey that going to the marina operators?
Yes. And every boat manufacturer gives their draft.
Right.
On the design of the boat. Now, there's some boats that are somewhat unique, like the Odyssey, but generally any boat that's sold has a spec on draft. So it doesn't need to be self-reported, you just need to go out and see what those boats are. And that's based on current use. That, the main thing about that is just getting a really good snapshot of current use, because we don't want to knock out a useless company going down the river. We want to foreclose the current use.
And we need to acknowledge that you know, the current use is already severely limited. So Jim and I both have the exact same boat for tours because it's one of the only boats that works for tours on the river. Because parts of this river are so severely choked with sediment from a lot of sources, but including from some of the sites being considered and studied, that we had to select vessels specifically to accommodate the already known lack of draft in this river. So there's going to be an artificial cheating to the shallow side of boats that are still able to be present in this river, simply because of the way the conditions have been affected.
That's not a Superfund issue.
No, it's an area issue.
It really, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, because the solids coming in from upstream, the entire watershed themselves are kind of part of the picture, part of the baseline, so I'm not following the NERVA point.
And this may be one of those issues that we're trying to challenge on.
So I brought this up 2 years ago, but I'm still very concerned about being able to carry the cross-sectional area, being able to carry the flow through here from 100, 200, 500 year storm that is not erosive. And we have not, I have not had sufficient answer to that. I think that is going to trump any boating issue that we have. The issue with boating is we have a federal channel, we need to maintain it to 8 feet. We're not trying to dig out the 45 feet in front of the Navy Yard so they can bring an aircraft carrier in here, or so the Washington Gas can bring barges up to their place. If you need more depth, that's great. But the issue is, to me, is do we have, not had a storm since Agnes of that magnitude here. We're due for one, we're going to have one, but what are the other issues associated with that that have been done to us that have nothing to do with Washington Gas, by the way, that the federal government may have done building levees, directing development, and things of that nature that are going to be discovered through the National Natural Resources Damage Assessment that need to be fixed. And maybe this has nothing to do with you guys, but there's a solution there that reduces sediment, that may reduce contaminated sediment, building a wetland, for instance, upstream. I expect that to be part of this solution. I want to integrate some of those other solutions. But I don't want to just solve, you know, your immediate NCP issues without resolving other issues of the watershed. That's why we're doing this in this open manner and trying to find what's the best solution. I would rather spend $100 million upstream reducing sediment or whatever it is, improving flow, than dread one tablespoon of stuff out of the river. I just want to be really clear about that, because I want to do what's best for the river, and I want to do what's best for what it's going to take to resolve this all together, that we're all happy. My vision is we're all going to be standing on a stage at some point when we did this together, we all came to this together. And, you know, I don't know if we'll sing Kumbaya, but I want to make sure that we're meeting everybody's needs in this. And, you know, if we start focusing down on, you know, the river only needs to be 4.6 feet deep because the deepest draft is 4.5, that's a quotient for disaster. We have way too much sediment still going on. If we dredge it just dredge it to 8 feet and it's still, the sediment load is the same, we have to dredge it again still. And so then, is that going to impact any capital we put in? All that needs to be taken into account. That's my point.
Steve, your cards up.
Those are outside the CERCLA area. The CERCLA area, certainly the remedies need to look at the question of sediment stability and what happens in floods. Sediment flow and velocity in particular is very important. And I think that's what RIs and FSs are specifically supposed to do, is look at that question. The Washington Navy Yard had a study done where, for example, they looked at flows even from extreme events, referring, I believe, to sediments in front of the Navy Yard, and concluded that resuspension, that's erosion from those events, really wasn't an issue in that area. Now, I have nothing to do with that and take no position on it. Just note that that was their conclusion. That kind of analysis is relevant to remedy effectiveness analysis everywhere.
And to boating, the issue isn't only depth, but width. the river at Benning Road, for instance, is choked down to a very narrow channel there. The rowers can't even get through part of it. So there has to be some dredging associated with access to other, you know, to clean out sediment that's in there. We have way too much sediment coming into the river. Let's just
put it. But that dredging on a site like that may or may not be part of the rot.
Absolutely, probably won't be part of the rot, but it's part of the entire process because, you know, if it's carrying contaminated sediment from above, we need to address that. If it's not, or, you know, we may want more sediment to cover material in the river if it's clean sediment like we're seeing.
I think this is a subject for a future meeting because I think what we're getting into here is the whole issue of capping versus removal. If we're going to be dealing with storm issues, we're going to be dealing with minimum depths and things like that, we're going to have to face that issue, and it's a cost issue. It costs a lot more money to remove the stuff than it does to cap it. And yet, it seems to me we're hearing a lot of reasons why we might want to make that additional investment.
Which initial investment?
To remove as opposed to cap. In order to have capacity of the river to handle storms and events that are coming.
Final word, Trey.
And to be clear, when we're talking about removing sediment, perhaps beyond what's necessary just for compliance with the Superfund for this or for that piece of it, there are other options for funding besides just the PRP's liability under CERCLA.
Okay.
So I think we would be foolish to sacrifice the opportunity to accomplish a lot of these goals while equipment is mobilized simply because we need to bend the accounting. I think the accounting can be structured such that we could perhaps leverage this project in order to really do what we're not going to get many hits at this kind of project. This is going to be a, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity to repair this river and to bring it back to where it should be.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say what I think I've said before on this issue of future use is all of these conversations feel way too much based on current use, which is certainly important, but again, what kind of boat you can get up the river today is smaller than 5 years ago, is smaller than 10 years ago, is smaller than 20 years ago, right? So it's like, to some extent, the moment in time that we're at is really limiting to what could be happening here and what was happening here in the time that many of us in the room have been working on the river. So, you know, saying like, well, you know, they have 4.5-foot boats at such and such marina, well, that's because that's literally all they can get up there, right? There's an 8-foot-high tunnel. I'm not going to drive a 9-foot-high truck through it, right? But if you rebuild the tunnel and it's 10 feet high, now I can drive my truck through it. So I understand to some extent that that's unknowable, but I just think we can't, as the depth of the river has clearly diminished over time, we can't take this point in time and extrapolate future use from here. We certainly need more data, but we need to account for the fact that the resource has been diminished over time.
Okay. I don't know how much time you want to spend on living shoreline for sediment reuse. I know that was kind of one of the last things. Let's park that to the side.
I'm going to go to that topic, but just to touch on that last topic because natural resource damage assessment term was used. And I think there was an initial presentation a long time ago on the basics of natural resource damage assessment. But so those are natural resource trustees, NOAA, Fish and Wildlife, DOEE. The damages are for injuries is a term to remember, that are caused by contaminants. So, for instance, there could be recreational injuries from not being able to catch fish, like from the Fish Consumption Advisory. And there could be recreational restoration projects, like things that are talked about. I'm not saying, you know, that I don't have no idea of the quantification, but they have to be scaled. But you can do things to enhance recreational activities on the river to compensate for recreational losses which occurred because of contaminants. And it's been mentioned before that, you know, the NRDA occurs after the cleanup stuff, and I've argued against that
and I still will again, we need to be talking about that. So that's DOI, that's NOAA, that's DOE. We need to start talking about in our DA. But moving into this topic of living shorelines and sediment reuse, that's a perfect example where at a particular remedy, you know, if you clean up something and say you dredged stuff and you can use that material in some way to create a living shoreline, restore habitat, you would get natural resource, you could potentially get natural resource credits for restoring habitat. And those are the opportunities that I think have been mentioned. And I've seen even conceptual type, you know, designs, plans from people like Pepco that are thinking that way. And that's the way to be thinking. That's really the way to be thinking about one mobilization versus two on a site-specific basis, for instance. So NRDA was on this agenda on the draft one, I noticed, and then it got taken off. So, and I understand there's limited time or whatever, but at some point, the DOI, NOAA, DOEE, at a minimum, should meet to start talking about natural resource damages. And then we could share it, because it should be the same open process.
Is it not in meetings of the trustees?
I'm sorry?
Is it not in meetings of the trustees?
No.
Okay. All right. Any final comments? This is what I think that I'd like to do. I'd like to regroup with the DC government team, look at the issues that have been raised over the past 2 days that we really need to revisit and get a little more clarification on. Together, and things like the, it's not micro, but just a smaller, finer approach to how we treat the river, that one depth, for example, may not serve all, that sort of thing that you brought up. And then also remedies that may, don't want to foreclose a remedy in the rod that may make sense for one particular area. I think we need to think about that. We need to think about the parallel process with NERDA in this. And so let us take this information back, and then also if there's anything in particular that you believe that the DC government needs to spend some more time on in particular, send it over to us and we'll make a decision about that. And then we meet together at least one more time to hash through some of the stuff that needs more definition together. That at least for us to be able to say, we're going to go this way or that way. And we do that. And so we'll set up a date that will be within a month. I know that my rule is that you don't meet in August, you see. So if you do this within a month, and if you'll see it in an early agenda, and also if we are able to get any reports, information that we have, whether it be on fish consumption advisory data or on the other reports that Gresham talked about, we get those out to you as soon as possible. But then I think we're going to have some key issues we need to come back to this group with. Questions?
Just like to make sure that sedimentation rates is part of that discussion if we're running out of time to talk about
it. Same as Trey's question, sedimentation rate?
Not quite, no. There were assumptions made in the FS about sedimentation rates in various areas that we believe at least are incorrect for the area near Washington Gaps.
Is your preliminary data showing higher or lower for your specific site?
Higher sedimentation rates.
Our sedimentation rates are based on the model, which is calibrated to the tributary state data. So it's a calibrated model. So,
but the season course, for example, there isn't particularly, there's a very small handful of those to look at sedimentation rates. And they show more sedimentation in a lot of areas than what the model predicts. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the model. And yet, essentially, it It's another one of the things like the statements about you need to have 12 inches of cover naturally within 20 years or else you can't have consider moderate natural cover for that area. You know, it's a similar question of, are we making an arbitrary cut? Is there really one centimeter a year? Has to be, you set a minimum how much sedimentation had to occur within a particular period, and it's, those don't fit well in particular areas of the river.
There are, I believe we attempted 12 feet in quarter on the river. I think we have about half a dozen that have good data that you can get rates from. I think there's independent data that say that, I mean, rates are not constant forever. They vary through time. They vary with what's going on in the watershed. So rates historically were higher, and other lines of evidence suggest decreasing. We can talk about all that.
I'm curious, what was your, were you sampling or using a different model or a conjunction of both?
We're looking at the various, mostly the others, the studies that were done in our area.
Which were physically sampling the sediment accumulation or?
I don't believe Washington Gas did cesium cores specifically itself.
There were cores taken by Walensky down there, by Poplar Point, Walensky, and some of our cores were down there.
Right. And so if deposition rates are in fact in excess of, say, 3 centimeters a year, then you're ending up with sedimentation that is sufficient to support a moderate, or some form of natural recovery, even moderate natural recovery or enhanced moderate natural recovery.
What was that observational period? Do you remember how recent?
No.
Okay. I would be very interested to hear more about that. So we expect to see drastically less sedimentation of the river, particularly the lower river, as we move forward, because the district and Montgomery County and Prince George's County have very successfully been implementing some pretty, you know, internationally leading stormwater work, and it's reducing sediment load, especially with the building that we're in, the district water tunnel, that it eliminated 2 million tons of trash from the river in just 9 months. I don't know what their sediment capture rate is, but I would be interested to see that. From DC Water, but I'd also think it's something that needs to be incorporated in either in reviewing old, potentially old data, but also I don't know how that's been worked. Has that been worked into the model?
Yeah, the tunnel is part of this. I mean, predictions are working the model.
Has their recent data been used to recalibrate the model, or at least to check? So DC Water, I don't know the issue,
no,
where they have sediment data, but they issued a bunch of other data about the first year of success with the tunnel.
We used the tributary study data, which is sort of in 2017.
So that's a pre-tunnel then?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's probably the one that needs to be looked at.
Yeah, but like when we project 10 years out what sedimentation rate would be, and that did include
the tunnel. So the tunnel has been 5 to 10% more effective at capture than it was predicted. So that I would encourage you to, in fact, ask you to please review that and let us know how that compares to what was currently or originally worked in. Thank you.
Okay. I think that we're close to your limit of tolerance before lunch. Jim and then Eric.
I'd just like to say that I think that this format is working really well with having us all in the room together, so we're all hearing it straight from each other, and that everything here is completely solvable. I just want to put that out.
Thanks, Jim.
Appreciate you that, Jim. My question is, where are we on the issues that were discussed at our last meeting, specifically after management, interim rods, BRGs? Have we closed the book on that? Is there more discussion? Is that part of what you're going to go back with your team and consider?
We definitely, as you know, believe that we included adaptive management in the FS. There's debate on whether you believe we did
did that, and so I think we have to go back and take a look on that. We have to also look at the process, like what kind of rod? Is it a preliminary rod, is it an interim rod, whatever the terminology is appropriate for EPA or for the CERCLA. And I know we, so on those things, yes, we have to go back and take a look. And then I also think that we have to be realistic on timelines. We have to be able to say, can we meet with what we're trying to do, the December timeline, for to meet your expectations of what will be in the trial. Okay? All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll get back to you about our next meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one.